This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
OG, I know you're already a member, but I wonder if the rest of our audience knows that becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you save and earn more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you could start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal's savings option for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project, maybe you want to consolidate debt. You could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed-rate home equity loan with zero closing costs, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Both options could help make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.
Welcome to another special episode of the Stacking Benjamin Show, year-end 2020 edition. I'm Joe Salci, Hi Average Joe Money on Twitter, and across the card table from me, my good friend OG. Happy holiday week, man.
Okay. I mean, I'm all for like giving some to the people, but is there a break coming sometime soon?
We have two more of these to do, today and tomorrow. And what, okay. You got to sit here for 10 minutes while we do this?
Okay.
I got to tell you, though, you're going to love today's episode. We're going all the way back again to 2013. So for those of you who are...
Those are my favorite episodes, the ones that I absolutely have no memory of.
I think you'll remember this one because we go back to 2013 here. And this is an episode of the show that we actually found this person watching CBS Sunday Morning. And I saw this interview and said, I wonder if he'll talk to us. And imagine my surprise when he said, yes, I'll talk. Imagine our surprise when anybody will talk to us. Let's be real. For those of you new to this, we are counting down 2020's quirkiest episode. To keep it PG-13, we call them quirky. Well, these episodes are quirky, but we'll call the year quirky. Ken Periani, though, back in 2013, wrote a book called Caveat Emptor, and he describes how he went from this schoolboy with no money to becoming, wait for it, a world-class forgery expert. And the FBI was on his trail. He was sure he was going to get caught much of the time. We also had a woman on the show who called herself the Making Sense Babe back in the day. She's going to talk about side gigs. We might get in a little bit into rules at the time. Remember, this is 2013. We try to take as many of the old 2013 rules out that don't apply anymore, but we might have missed one. So just like Ken Periani's book, OG, is called Caveat Emptor.
Same thing, right?
Yes. Same exact thing. All right, here we go. Number two on our top seven most quirky guest on the Stacking Benjamin Show, The Life of an Art Forger, back from October 22nd, 2013.
Ma'am, I'm sorry to have to tell you, your son is forging checks.
Forging checks? Wait, I'm sure we can take care of that. I'm working part-time at the church now. Just tell me how much he owes and I'll pay you back.
So far, it's about $1.3 million.
Live live from my parents' basement. This is episode 26 of the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe Saul Sehy, average Joe on our blog. And with my partner in crime, the other guy, we operate this super secret podcast about earning, saving, and spending with a plan. You'll find notes for the show at stackingbenjamins.com. And you can send all your emails with questions, comments, or your feelings about artwork to Joe at stackingbenjamins.com. And here he is, the world's best thief. I don't know. OG.
Wow. Have you seen the previews for that new movie, American Hustle?
Yes. Doesn't that look good?
That looks awesome, doesn't it? And it's, you know, it looks like they're hustling artwork, doesn't it, a little bit?
Yeah, Cheryl doesn't think that it looks great, but I think, hey man, that 70s look that it's got, it's awesome.
That's going to be great. Well, I think it's based a little bit on true story.
Yeah, well, we've got the true story for everybody today, which is very cool. I can't wait to get to that. And that's why we actually played the Catch Me If You Can clip at the beginning. We cut your son forging checks. Oh, that's fine. How much do you owe? About $1.5 million. Whoops. Hey, before we get too far, so we can hopefully accumulate $1.5 million, actually about $1.5 million pesos, $1.5 million yen. If while you're doing your holiday shopping, you go to stackingbenjamins.com/Amazon, guess where you end up, OG, if you do that?
I'm going to say Amazon.
Bam! Right again. It's the same exact Amazon, and guess what you do? You actually help out this show, and you can hear OG on his brand flipping new microphone. So you sound ultra sexy today.
I need one of those like things that like the musicians have that go wow, 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 wow. Like the, you know, when they talk into the little thingy or make the guitar make the weird noise.
Yeah, well, hey, on today's show, Ken Perenni, author of the book Caveat Emptor, is with us. And you know what he did? He made a bunch of money pretending his artwork had actually been created by some of the world's greatest masters.
Pretended.
Yeah, what do you think about that? I mean, do you think that if somebody gets a piece of artwork and they think it's real, and it's real enough to them and it looks real on their wall, do you think that it's a victimless crime?
Very interesting. I have never been one to look at artwork and go, I could pay $1 million for that. That doesn't seem like anything to me. I have, however, for the first time ever, seen stuff that really left me, you know, speechless when I was in an art gallery in South Florida. Literally speechless. I couldn't move. It was just breathtaking. So I guess, and at that moment, I thought, I will pay whatever it takes to get this in my house because it's amazing. So I guess at the end of the day, if you're happy with it and, you know, and it leaves you breathless, then what the heck's it matter? What value, price is nothing more than just what somebody's willing to pay for an exchange of goods and services. I guess where the deceit comes in is whether or not
but if you think
it's something that it's not.
Yeah, but if you think you're getting one thing, you're thinking one person did it and somebody else who's very, very good at copying actually did it. You know, and by the way, speaking of that art that left you breathless.
The original Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah, right. That artwork, though, that left you breathless in Miami, I didn't know that the Velvet Elvis had that effect on you. Let's move.
That's not where I was.
I got an article here today, OG, from the Investment News called Turning Advice on Its Head. I'll link to it in the show notes. It's by an author, Dan Jamieson. And he's talking about this guy, Joe Duran, who is a top executive at a company called United Capital out of Newport Beach, California. Mm-hmm. United Capital is one of these firms that is taking small boutique financial advisor firms and they're scooping them up. And all these financial advisory firms are working independently, supposedly, but on the back end, really, they're getting this economy of scale that supposedly United Capital brings. Well, the big reason I wanted to bring it up today has nothing to do with that. It actually has to do with the fact that they're trying to bring a more relaxed atmosphere to financial planning. And what Mr. Duran talks about in this article is how he's hoping that people respond better to an advisor who has an open shirt, a more relaxed feel than that button-down suit and tie look that advisors have.
Like an open shirt with, like, you know,
tons of chest
hanging out, like a big V-neck 70s party, like we were talking earlier, like kind of open shirt.
Yeah, right.
A polo shirt.
So what do you think about going into meetings with clients and having that look? Do you think people expect a banker look when they come in? Do you think that affects the relationship?
I don't know. I'll tell you, from in my own practice, we have gotten very lax on dress code. So much so that on occasion, I've been known to wear jeans in the office.
When clients are there?
It happens. We wear a lot of golf clothes, you know, like golf pants and a polo shirt or something like that, as evidenced by my frequency at golfing. So that's a little bit, that's more like, it's not even business casual per se. It's, you know, I guess they would call that country club casual perhaps. And anecdotally, in my practice, when I wear a shirt and tie, or God forbid, an actual suit coat, and clients come in, they say, now they say, why are you so dressed up?
So they're suspicious of it.
Yeah. What's going on? Why are you so dressed up? Am I in trouble? I think that the pendulum has swung too far that direction. And I've actually made it known to our team that, you know, starting the first of the year, we're gonna start having a little bit more formal kind of dress code requirements, more predictability. And I will probably go back to wearing a shirt and tie. But I think that it's less to do about the clients and how they feel and more about the advisor and how he or she feels. It seems to me that when I wear jeans and a t-shirt to the office, I kind of feel more floating around, you know, I'm just kind of there going through the motions. But if I show up in a, you know, a suit.
You mean business.
I mean business today. We're going to get work done. So.
You know, when I was practicing, I found that clients of a certain net worth expected me to wear a tie, especially though in my practice, because of the whole television thing, they saw me in a suit and tie on TV, and then they expected the same look when they came to the office. I'll say this. I tried to change that, OG, when I went to the TV station one time without a tie. I was talking about a very blue collar topic. And so I thought, hey, I'll go in with a polo shirt. And the producer pulled me over and said, our viewers expect you in a suit and tie. You're the finance guy. You need to be in a suit and tie. And I said, well, I'm trying to change that. I'm trying to make it relaxed and where we relate. And the guy said, oh, I think we'll relate better to you in a suit and tie.
Yeah, no, I think there's something to do with that. I don't know.
I found for younger clients were more suspicious of the suit and tie. People starting out, people that maybe had a high income but not a lot of net worth yet, where my 50 and 60 and 70 year old clients that already built their castle and now they were trying to protect it, those people were more suspicious if I wore jeans or a polo shirt.
Well, and I know that you used to do this too, especially when you do speaking engagements. I do it all the time. So when I'm doing a speaking engagement, I'll wear a suit, of course, but cater to the audience. So we just did a client event or a, you know, prospecting event a couple of nights ago. And it was with very blue-collar people. And you're right. They might feel a little, oh, that guy's like management, you know, management, you know. So what I always do when I'm speaking to a group and I know that they're going to be maybe a little more blue-collar, or maybe they're guys that work on the line type of thing or something like that, is I'll start, hi, I'm OG, blah, 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 blah. And I'll say, guys, do you mind? I feel all stuffy like this. Can I? Mind if I take my coat off and kind of loosen it tight? It is already 6 o'clock.
And you get their buy-in.
And I'll take the coat off. I'll roll my sleeves up, loosen my tie, and button the top button. I'm not the stuffy management representative that they first saw. I'm, you know, a guy that that might be, so to speak, on their level.
I've done that in meetings with clients before where I'll start with the tie, and then I'll realize that maybe it feels a little formal. I'm getting a little, you know, a little formal feel from the clients, and I want to relax the meeting. So I will then say, hey, do you mind if I take off the jacket? And you'll see people relax. You know, it's interesting because what we're really talking about is not at all, this is nothing to do, OG, with whether you give good advice or not. You know, it's all about dress code and people's perceptions about who they think that their advisor should be. Should people be looking past the way somebody looks? Are there clues to the way somebody looks, whether they're a good advisor or not?
I think that you should look past the way somebody looks. You know, you can dress like $1 million and still give terrible advice.
Well, I'll tell you, sometimes people look too much like $1 million to me. I've been in meetings with some advisors. Actually, it was a mortgage guy, and he very, very deliberately made sure that I knew he had a Rolex on. Right. And I was out of there. I'm like, I am not paying for your Rolex. I want nothing to do with that.
I do the same thing. So you got to kind of dress down everything that happens in your life in some respects. I'm not ashamed about the amount of income that we make as a family. My wife works and I work and we make a nice living. And I'm also not ashamed of the stuff that I have, but I make sure that people understand that you know, just because I drive a fancy luxury sedan doesn't mean I spent fancy luxury sedan prices to get it. So I'll tell the story of, yeah, I have a $100,000 car, but I didn't buy a $100,000 car. I bought it for $26,500 because some other idiot bought it for $100,000 and burned all the depreciation out of it. And I got it for, I got it when it had 35,000 miles on it for $26,000. My car costs less than your Buick.
So Ken is upstairs with Mom right now. I wonder if he even forged his credentials that Mom always likes to look through to make sure that they're okay to come into the basement.
I thought he didn't do that anymore.
He actually doesn't do that anymore, and he's going to tell that story, but I thought it was a fun joke. Come on. Come on.
No, I like that. Sorry. Redo. Take two.
Yeah. And boy, talking to Ken, just what an interesting fellow, and his book, Caveat Emptor, is a fantastic book.
Could you get that on Amazon if you wanted to?
You could, and you know what? We'll have a link.
We should put a link to that on the show notes.
That is brilliant, OG. That's great. But before we do that, let's welcome Ken to the basement. What happens when you have a gift, but that gift is copying other people? In Las Vegas, people pay hundreds of dollars to see Impressionists, right? We teach people to emulate the stars to get famous. What about in the art world? Ken Perenia has a real gift in that area. He's one of the few people in the world who isn't allowed in the major art museums because he was a professional forger. And he's here to share with us his gift that he's detailed in his new book, Caveat Emptor. Well, welcome to the basement, Ken. Glad you can join us.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, now, here in Mom's basement, we don't have any real art unless you can reproduce dogs playing poker. Would that sell well?
I don't know if there's a big market for that these days.
That Mom's going to be very disappointed by that. So when did you realize that this gift of yours of reproduction was so good that you could pass it off as the real thing?
Well, when I sold my first fake, I was 17 going on 18, and I needed money to fix up an old car that I was driving around, and I had already tried my hand at painting. I discovered that I had a proclivity to imitate the style of the old masters, and when a friend of mine, an artist and a mentor, gave me a book on the subject of forgery, I followed its instructions very carefully, created my first fake, a Flemish portrait, only around maybe 10 by 12 inches in size, aged it and cracked it according to methods I read in the book, and managed to sell it to a gallery on 57th Street in New York City, and walked out with $800. And that was the beginning of it.
Did you walk out that day with $800, or did they have to call in some other experts to verify it?
No, I was in and out in a space of 2 hours, but it seemed like an eternity for me. I wasn't sure what they were doing with the painting. They took it into another room. They were examining it, and I heard bottles being rattled around, and I was doing all I can to control my fear and emotions at that time. But they did buy it, and I walked out of the gallery with the cash.
Is there a type of painting that was easier to reproduce than any other type?
Well, I would say for me it was kind of an evolution. I started painting surrealistic paintings for myself, for my own pleasure, but they had very much of a quality of an old master in technique. So it was easy for me to make the transition into art forgery. I would say it's not a matter of any particular type of a painting. It's more understanding a technique, which I mastered, that could be applied to many different schools of period painting.
Does painting run in your family? Were your parents painters?
No, not at all. My father was a factory worker in Jersey City, New Jersey, but he had a great mechanical mind. Many people relied on him in the factory to solve the most complicated problems. His fellow workers said he was a genius, And maybe I got a little bit of his brains, but it channeled into artwork. But no, there was really no interest in art in my family.
I'm curious what you told your dad then, and maybe even your friends, how you were coming up with this money.
Well, I was painting my own pictures. As I mentioned, they were kind of bizarre, surrealistic pictures. It was the 60s. The hippie movement was in full swing. So I was trying to fit in with a lot of new friends I had in the art world and be far out, do something shocking and bizarre. So I had a good cover story that I was making a few bucks selling my pictures.
Yeah. After that first one, was it the thrill or is it just the continued need for money? And I mean, did it just become like a 9-to-5 job for you, Ken?
It was a continued need for money. My intention was to move into New York City, which I did. Got a little studio for myself, but my intention was to become a legitimate painter. I wanted to become part of the abstract expressionist movement that was developing at that time. I had a good idea for a collection of artwork, but I always needed money to pay the rent and to keep myself alive, buy supplies and so on. So instead of taking a day job, as a lot of artists do, I would just simply make another little fake, go out and sell it, raise cash, and go back to my more serious work. But as time went on, my reliance on faking became more absolute until finally it developed into a full-blown career.
I think it had to have been frustrating. I'm just trying to put myself there that you're doing the forgeries to create time so you can work on what you think of as your art, and your art isn't selling, but this stuff that's been around for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years is flying off the shelf.
Well, yes, it was a little frustrating. It wasn't a problem of my artwork not selling. I was in a development stage and I was getting attention from a lot of important people downtown who wanted to see what I could produce. But it seemed like events kept conspiring against me and I found myself being evicted and thrown out from one place to another. And it so disrupted my work that I was never able to fully put the collection together that I envisioned. So I had to keep relying on creating another antique painting to raise money to pay everyday expenses.
We're speaking with Ken Perrani, author of Caveat Emptor. And so at some point, the FBI got on your trail. How did you first find out that they were hot in pursuit of you, Ken?
Well, I didn't have any forewarning. They just showed up at my house one day and asked to come in. And at first I was wondering what they could possibly want with me. Because by this time, this was 1998 when this occurred, I had been faking paintings now for over 30 years. And I was quite confident in my abilities to not get caught. So it was a bit unpleasant to have the FBI visit me and want to start talking to me about paintings that were showing up in various venues in New York and London. So I realized at that time that this could be the beginning of the end of my career, which it was. I found myself under a federal investigation that dragged on for 5 long years. And it was difficult to endure that. And in the meantime, I was pretty much out of business also.
Hey, for people who invest in collectibles, was there a way they would have known that their investment in this thing that they thought they were buying, that they weren't really buying, that they could have found out what it was? I mean, was there some clue that people were missing?
Yeah, there is a clue if you know where to look for it, in the sense that if you want to take your painting and subject it to scientific analysis, it would probably turn up anachronisms. However, you have to have a reason to do that. And if you buy a painting from a reputable gallery or, you know, one of the major auction houses, and you're buying it with a statement from them that they believe this painting is to be by the artist that it's represented to be, I think you would have confidence that you had the genuine article and there would be no need to subject it to any kind of chemical analysis. As far as visually, I felt that my paintings were impeccable and would not in any way bring upon them or draw any suspicion to them at all.
I've watched two national interviews with you in which, you know, the interviewers brought in someone who calls you a liar or calls you a cheat. What do you think when you hear those terms?
Well, I think they're entitled to their opinion. It doesn't bother me in the least. In fact, I even enjoy listening to them. I'm proud of the achievements that I've accomplished. I have nothing to be ashamed of. I feel that there's very few people, if any, in the world that could master the range of artists that I have. And I'm not bothered by their opinion in the least. There's always going to be people like that. So, but it doesn't have any effect on me at all.
Have you had any of the any museums or any art collectors ask you or hire you as a consultant to help them find other people that might be forging?
No, I have not been approached in that capacity, but I have had museums and major institutions approach me for vetting of paintings and so on, but not as far as tracking down other forgers. I really wouldn't even know where to begin doing that.
The funniest part to me of your story is that now that you're even more well-known than you were before, and your book, Caveat Emptor, is on every bookstore and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everywhere else. Now you're in higher demand than ever for your reproductions. Is there a waiting list?
Yes, in some cases, I'm pretty booked up on for demands on, especially James E. Buttersworth. That's a very sought after marine painter of the 19th century who I mastered. In a strange way, I'm actually probably better off now and have more opportunity now than I did in the old days. The only problem is I'm missing the intoxicating thrill of taking a risk and getting away with something. So I have to take what I can get and be happy.
Yeah, where do you get that fix now, Ken?
It's hard to replace it. Life is pretty dull without it.
Well, for someone who's new to the art world, where would you tell that person to start if they're really ready to, you know, maybe begin their own collection?
Well, that's a good question. You can begin by educating yourself, read all about the artists that you're interested in investing in, do a lot of research, and understand the market for that artist. Understand what his values are for a good painting and what he brings for a poor painting. A lot of people buy a poor painting by a great artist and think they have something. So you really have to know the range and how the market effect on the different periods of the artist. And then you have a choice. You could either buy at the auction houses where you'll probably get your best price. But there's also an element of risk there. You really have to know what you're buying at the auction house. You have to be your own expert. However, you could go to the high-end galleries in New York and London and purchase retail, but you're going to pay more. But then you have the guarantee of hopefully a big-name gallery, a reputable dealer, so that if you find out you have a painting that isn't what it's supposed to be, you have an easy recourse to for a refund. But you're always better off at the auction house, but you have to understand what you're buying.
Hey there, trivia mavens. It's Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, here with the highlight of your show. So I just got a look at that forgery dude Ken's signature on the guest book down here in the basement. And I immediately realized I'd seen that handwriting before. It's on all the royalty checks that Joe's been giving me. No wonder those things are bouncing like a three-year-old hopped up on Red Bull. Okay, here's some fascinating money trivia for your pre-Halloween festivities. In financial terms, what is known as a zombie? I'll be back later with the answer. But I think that making sense, babe, feminine is Wiles to steal the microphone from me. That woman is amazing.
Because all the people who like to confuse the crap out of you are busy. Here's Making Sense, Babe.
This is a little bit of a rant, so just giddy up, folks, and get ready. How many times have you guys been asked this question? What are you doing with your website? What's the point of it? Why do you spend so much time on it if you don't get paid for what you're doing? Okay, let me start by saying that all of you who have asked those questions definitely do not have a side project. You have no goals or endeavors outside of your typical 9-to-5 job. I know this because if you did have a side project you were working on, you would not ask those asinine questions. This is you. Get a drink. You go to work. You come home. You stalk people on Instagram or Facebook, and then you meet your friend for a drink who cannot meet for dinner because she's working on her side project. While having a drink, you ask her all sorts of stupid questions about what she's doing with her side project, like, what's the point of it if you're not getting paid? All right, let's be honest. What's really going on is you don't have a side project you're working on, so you look for reasons why someone would work so hard at something if they're not getting paid. Reasons that you'll inevitably shoot down to further justify your laziness. That is you, and we know who you are. You're not happy with what you're doing in your life. You probably hate your job and you're not doing anything about it. So it's just really hard for you to get excited for people who are actually making changes in their lives. And that brings me to my next 2 points. You do not have a side project because, number one, you're lazy. And number two, you're afraid of failing. Yes, you're too lazy to carry your laptop everywhere you go. You're too lazy to come home from work and start working on your side project because you've been working all day at a job you probably hate. And yes, in case you didn't get what I'm saying, you're too lazy to work on something when you're not entirely sure what the payout is. And this last point is the biggest difference between you and those of us who strive for more. Here's the thing, people who are successful with side projects do not initially worry about the end payout or how much money they're gonna get paid. We know that the whole thing is a freaking adventure, and the path to the end goal, whatever it is definitely not a straight line. There are offshoots that happen each day that get us excited to keep on working. And I'll tell you this, unlike you, we're sure not worried about failing. There's a big difference between people who believe their intelligence can grow and people who believe their intelligence is fixed. Now, studies show that people who believe their intelligence can grow learn from their mistakes. And guess what? They do in fact learn and make adjustments and small tweaks and get better and better and better. People who have side projects fail every single day. Oh my God, that post I just gave to someone sucked. Oh my God, that podcast I just gave to Stacking Benjamins was the worst. We fail every single day. But our brains work differently than yours. We're not afraid of failing. So here's the thing. There's really no way to fail with a side project unless you keep making the same mistake over and over. But the thing is we use these things that seem like failures as springboards to make us smarter and smarter. All right, so let's settle this side project mumbo jumbo once and for all. The reason you have a side project is to get going in the general direction of where you want to go. Maybe you just want to get exposure to a certain area that you want to learn about. Your motivation to work on the side project is not necessarily to get paid along the way. The payout is when you see something happening as a result of your side project that you could get paid for. Maybe it's not exactly what you thought you were starting with your side project. Maybe it's some sort of offshoot. Okay, so in case you've had this entire thing on mute this whole time, the takeaway is for all of you who don't have a side project and keep asking your friends why they're working on something and not reaping immediate monetary benefits, I hope you now see that you are the foolish one. You are going to you know what in the bed one day when you see that working on something you actually enjoy does pay off in bigger ways that you could ever imagine.
Has your pet helped you get through the pandemic this year? You know, I'd like to say that Mr. Cooper, sitting here with me as we record today, got Mom and Cheryl and I through the year. But nope, as Cheryl and I were doing the nomadic thing, living all over the place, in the worst year, by the way, to live all over the place, Cooper kept my mother-in-law company, which was kind of funny because she says that she's not a cat person. And yet now, that Cooper's got, first of all, she didn't want to see Cooper leave when we went to pick him up. And then number two, I would say that I thought she was going to start crying, but she really did start crying, which was incredibly awkward. I mean, Mr. Cooper is a badass, but I really felt bad for my mother-in-law because in a year like this year, when so many people, especially seniors, don't have a lot of people to talk to, having Cooper there with her, I think was fantastic. So the same way Cooper's essential to my mother-in-law, who doesn't ask when she calls about Cheryl or I or about her grandkids. She just asks about Cooper, all she asks about. Much like Cooper's been essential, PetSmart's been an essential retailer, making sure you can get everything your pet needs right when you need it. Over 1,600 convenient locations, and they lead the pack with safe and easy ways to shop. Of course, you already know that PetSmart's associates really love pets. And caring for them is a big part of why they work there. And as an essential retailer since the beginning of the pandemic, PetSmart's made it safe and easy for you to care for your pet online or in stores. How about this? PetSmart right now is offering free same-day delivery, powered by DoorDash, through January 31st, 2021. So you can get everything your pet needs. This is through January 31st of 2021, right at your door, right when you need it. At PetSmart, the health and safety of employees, pet parents, and pets are what's most important, which is why they require face coverings, support social distancing, and enhanced cleaning to follow CDC recommendations. Or if you're interested in contactless shopping, I almost said curbside pickup. That's coming, by the way. We're going to talk about curbside pickup. But if you're interested in contactless shopping, just order online at PetSmart.com or on the PetSmart app and enjoy easy curbside pickup or free same-day delivery powered by DoorDash through January 31st, 2021. So you can get everything your pet needs right to your door and right when you need it. Check out PetSmart.com for more details. That's right, Mr. Coop. He just got up, rubbed against my leg. Check out PetSmart.com for more details. He's like, hey, Dad, why don't you go check out some of those cat toys for me? Right, dude?
Yo, trivia fans, get this. That Making Sense babe actually just told me that I've got the best mullet she's ever seen. Ever. That girl's hotter than a $10 pistol, and she's got her eyes on me. Smart girl. Okay, where was I? Trivia! Here's that question again, folks. In financial terms, what's known as a zombie? Well, here you go. A zombie is a company that continues to operate even though they're bankrupt. That's a funny name, huh? They also call those companies the Walking Dead. Speaking of Walking Dead, let's get back to Joe and OG.
I got a great idea, OG.
What's that?
Let's give something away. This month, we're giving away Jane Blaufuss's book. She is the woman who was on the podcast last month talking about the situation with her husband who passed away in a car accident when she was in her 30s. And she wrote that great book, OG, called Claim Your Life with a Stroke of a Pen. Fantastic book about getting your insurances. That's something people don't like to talk about. People can't stand talking about insurances, OG.
I love talking about insurance because it makes people uncomfortable.
And that's what you're all about.
I'm all about, it's like we were talking about before with the clothes and everything. I come in wearing sweatpants. I haven't shaved in a week and a half or taken a shower in 3 days. And I'm like, no, trust me. You're rolling over safe here. I got this.
Anyway, that's a train wreck discussion. Sorry. Back to what we were talking about. We're giving away Jane Blaufuss's book.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, we're giving it away. All right, cool.
And here's how you win it. Three ways to win it. And I got to say, last month, only 8 people entered. And we usually get hundreds of people entering. So apparently a lot of people didn't want Jeff Rose's book. Maybe not. I don't know. Or they thought, heck, I don't have a chance to win. Well, you have a great chance to win. Here's what you got to do.
one of three things. First of all, if you go to stackingbenjamins.com/October, we'll give you the three ways. And you just click the buttons as you've done them. You tweet about the show. Number two is you like us on Facebook. That's Facebook.com/iStackBenjamins. And then the third way is just the easiest one. Go back and listen to the shows last month, OG, and tell us who this voice is.
Write that down. And ladies can also reverse engineer the situation. How? Smile. A study shows that when average-looking girls smile when they're sitting at the bar, she had 5 times as many guys approach her as when she's not smiling.
And that woman appeared on a show in September. Who do you think that was, OG?
Oh, that is definitely Carrie Underwood.
Oh, you are so, so, so far away. It is not Carrie Underwood. OG doesn't have it, but he narrowed the field for you. It's somebody other than Carrie Underwood who appeared on the show in September. All you do is go to stackingbenjamins.com/October. And maybe you'll be one of two people to go into the cage match at the beginning of November, the coin flip of death, to win Jane's book. Hey, Stackers, one more thing before we say goodbye. If you're an active duty service member, veteran, DOD civilian, military family member, you can join Navy Federal. That means if you've served in any branch of the military, like OG or my dad, you can join Navy Federal Credit Union. On average, Navy Federal members earn and save, listen to this, $3,611 more per year. You could pay no fees, get low rates and rate discounts, plus earn cash back and grow your savings. Have a large credit card balance after the holidays? Let Navy Federal Credit Union help you rebalance your priorities. Make a plan to do away with high interest credit card debt by transferring your balance to a Navy Federal credit card. With a low intro APR and no balance transfer fees, you can pick the right card to help you take back control. Visit NavyFederal.org. Navy Federal Credit Union, our members are the mission. Insured by NCUA, dollar value of Navy Federal's 2019 member give back study, 25.9-9 to 18% variable APRs based on product type and credit worthiness, up to $1 cash advance transaction fee at non-Navy Federal ATMs. Short show this week, OG.
Oh, my God. I mean, oh, too bad.
Oh, darn.
Son of a gun. Well, you're headed out of town.
Yeah, I'm not going to have time to edit this. As this comes out, I will be just returning home from the Financial Blogger Conference.
Cool.
In the next couple of weeks, we're going to have a lot of footage from that like we did last year. If you go back to the old Two Guys and Your Money shows from this time last year, we had a ton of great interviews.
Nice. And I really wanted to come to this, but to protect my identity, I'm just not allowed.
You would have had to wear a bag over your head the whole time.
Well, I have to do that anyway when I go out, but I was thinking more of like one of those like masquerade masks. Have you seen, speaking of masquerade masks, have you seen that Most Interesting Man commercial about the masquerade masks?
No.
It's like a little PG-13. You know what I'm talking about, right? The Dos Equis guy.
The Dos Equis guy, yeah.
So it pans to him and on the subtext says, on masquerade parties, like dot, dot, dot. And it pans up to him, and there's, you know, he's sitting there with two women that got their masks on, and he says, "It's the only thing that comes off at the unmasking hour are the masks. You've done something wrong." Stay thirsty, my friends.
Stay thirsty. Yeah, well, this
I love clever marketing stuff, man. It really is cool when you find a company that's kind of nailing it, you know.
Yeah, well, that's why, well, like I talked about in the short stack on Friday, I love that MasterCard commercial.
Right, yeah, the pirate ones.
The pirate one. Yeah, getting out of there in the nick of time. Yeah, and you've got young kids, you know all about that.
Oh, yeah.
I had a situation like that with my daughter. She is, well, you know what? I might tell that story a different time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no problem. Let's do it another time then.
Yeah, let's do it another time. maybe later.
Maybe later.
Maybe. But for now, we've got these are the juiciest two movies you and I have reviewed in a week. in a long time. For those of you new to the podcast, at this point in the show, we no longer talk about financial planning. OG and I both love to go see movies or to watch movies at home, watch TV series. So we try to give you a little
We're generally quite slothy when it comes to life in general. We like to sit in one place
and eat popcorn.
Be entertained. Right. Entertain me.
Bring me the biggest tub of popcorn you can.
Cherry Coke.
This week we saw two movies. We'll start with yours first. This was a new Tom Hanks movie called Captain Phillips.
This is Mask, Alabama. We are an unarmed freighter. We have a potential piracy situation.
Copy, Alabama. You should alert your crew. Get your fire hoses ready. Chances are it's just fishermen.
They're not here to fish.
Listen up. We have been boarded by armed pirates.
Stay hidden at all costs. No one any hostages.
We will follow the procedures. Lock down, go dead in the water, and wait for help.
Stick together, and we'll be all right.
Where is the crew?
I don't know.
You think you're playing? You think we're playing?
If you're going to shoot somebody, shoot me! Hey.
Look at me.
Sure.
Look at me. I'm the captain now.
1 minute, I kill all your friends. 1 minute.
So Captain Phillips is a movie that's based, from what I gather, pretty close to a true story. Everybody has heard this story about the Somali pirates who capture the Maersk, Alabama. Captain Phillips is the captain. The movie portrays how he got off the boat and so on and so forth. I don't know how accurate that was. It starts with Tom Hanks being a cautious captain. He's concerned about his shipping route. He's concerned about pirates and all the stuff that's going on now. Of course, the U.S. Navy now has a very strong presence in that area. I haven't heard anything about piracy off the Horn of Africa in a couple of years.
Yeah, right.
And I think this is what kind of started that impetus for us to sort of get involved, I guess, to some degree. It's basically Castaway with words and pirates. So if you saw Castaway, imagine that he was having conversations with pirates instead of himself or the volleyball, Mr. Wilson, and you've got Captain Phillips. The hardest part about this movie, it was 2.5 hours long. The hardest part is there's no change of scenery. He's on a boat or in a boat the entire time, except for the time that he's flying to the boat, which is the very intro of the movie. It's all about the boat. And then he ends the movie on a boat on the Navy ship. There is absolutely no ability to build suspense in this movie, because if you know anything, and I can't say that I'm spoiling this by any stretch of the imagination, right? He lives at the end. More specifically, he lives because three Navy SEAL snipers shoot the bad guys in the face at the same time, which is a feat remarkable in and of itself. If you know anything about competitive shooting or anything like that, three people shooting three separate things, moving from the deck of one ship to another ship.
Bouncing in the water.
Yeah, in the water, in the dead of night, having this happen is just a miraculous feat in and of itself. That should be the headline of this movie, how these guys are so darn good that three independent guys can shoot bad guys. But it's so hard because throughout the entire movie, you're going, oh, no, maybe the pirates don't get on board. Oh, wait, yeah, they do, because you know why? Because the Navy SEALs shoot the bad guys in the face at the end.
Because I know this story, right?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, maybe he won't get in the boat with the bad. Oh, no, he does get in the boat with the bad guys.
It's
oh, he's going to swim away. Maybe he's no, he's not going to swim away because he gets rescued by the Navy guys at the end. Because
I already know that.
Yeah.
I think Tom Hanks, though, does a great job playing this part.
I think he plays it well.
He hasn't had a lot of big, you know, wow roles lately. He's been panned, or his movies have been panned. Maybe not him, but the movies have been panned lately. And this movie's gotten great reviews.
It's great reviews. I think what you'll see, this is what I observed if you watch the movie, he goes from being a good actor to all of a sudden, it's almost like the director said, okay, now is the time when you have to get really emotional because it's the end of the movie. And all of a sudden, he's like, ah, don't kill me, you know. But of course, you're going, man, I know he doesn't die. It looks scary, but he doesn't die. And the reason I know that is because the Navy SEAL snipers shoot the guys in the face at the end. And then the very end of the movie, you know, he gets rescued and so on and so forth. But
so what's different than this than like a Zero Dark 30? I mean, because we know how that ends too, but that felt suspenseful, and I was on pins.
Well, there were a lot. There are a lot of parts of that story that you didn't know. You knew good guys get bad guy, but you didn't know the story in between. And Zero Dark 30 was the culmination of 8 years of this woman's work trying to track down this person. So that was the story of how did she work so hard and how many roadblocks did she. This is a movie about an event that half spanned, what, 3 days? All in one place, on a boat or inside of a boat. Eh.
Yeah,
I give
like...
it a sideways thumb.
Hmm.
I was really hoping that it was going to be awesome because it got, you know, like a zillion percent on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
But cinematography-wise, it's kind of boring. There's no change of scenery. While people are saying, oh, Tom Hanks did a great job. It's almost like he was Tom Hanks, and then all of a sudden, it's the last 10 minutes, they went, oh, get really emotional now because you're about to die. Oh, and then he starts crying. The whole time, he's calm, and he is rationalizing, reasoning with the bad guys and all that sort of stuff, and doing what you'd expect a well-seasoned adult would do when he's facing these children, basically, is what it was. And it felt artificial, and there was a complete inability to raise suspense because the story was, man gets on boat, man gets captured by pirates, man gets rescued by the U.S. Navy.
Ta-da! Yeah.
2.5 hours later. So, sideways thumb.
That's a long movie.
It's 2 hours and some change.
Yeah, for 3 hours of stuff. As an aside, I was at the port of Long Beach a few weeks, not before this movie, but a few weeks before another pirate incident happened with a boat called Cirrus. And we took one of those harbor cruises that you take out, you know, but they throw a bunch of people out there and, you know, they get... the narrator guy, and anyway,
we do those. They're called booze cruises.
Yes, this was booze cruise minus booze.
Oh, well, swell. Sounds awesome.
Plus family.
Minus fun equals
yes, right.
Vacation. Got it.
So they took us out, and the Sirius, maybe a week and a half before that was boarded by Somali pirates, was actually so we had seen it. So when they said the big ship Sirius. Yep, there I was. I saw it.
Huh.
All right, on my end, I saw another hit movie that's gotten a lot of great reviews, and the one I saw, was called Gravity.
Explorer's been hit. Explorer, do you read? Explorer, over. Explorer. Astronaut is off structure.
What do I do?
Dr. Stone is off structure.
What do I do?
Dr. Stone is attached. No. You must see Pat.
So Gravity is this film where from 10 minutes into the film, you know that they are completely screwed.
I love it so far. I love that idea.
Yeah, and what's annoying about this movie afterwards, not about seeing the movie, but afterwards, supposedly some astrophysicists have come out saying, oh, that could never happen. But you know what? If you can't suspend disbelief for just 15 seconds, because it's a movie and this one isn't based on, somebody asked me the other day, I think it was a woman cutting my hair, is that based on real events? No.
Oh, I don't know anything about Gravity, but how is it profoundly different from the concept of Apollo 13?
It's
man lost in space.
The only thing that it has in common with that is that they're screwed
in space.
Yeah. And what's great about this movie is that I had heard ahead of time, everybody raving about it. That's all I heard, was that all the critics were raving about it and it was coming to theaters. And Cheryl kept asking me, what's the movie about? I'm like, well, I think they're in space and they're screwed. Oh, gee, for me to tell you anything else about this movie would be a complete crime. They're in space. They're screwed. I'll tell you this. I hate 3D. I think 3D is a fad. It's got to go away. But I also heard ahead of time, got to see this movie in 3D. You know what I'll tell you? You got to see this movie in 3D. the 3D effects in this movie made it well worth the extra expense to see. My son actually saw it in IMAX 3D. And I think because of, you know, in space and these beautiful views of the Earth, the IMAX experience would have been even better. So if you can see this in IMAX 3D, go see it. This movie's about the visuals, the cinematography, the pacing. There's one piece of the movie I really didn't like. They go on and on about Sandra Bullock's daughter and about her relationship, and they're trying to build some empathy into the movie, and it just, to me, felt like a little, like they were spraying a little Velveeta in there.
Contrived.
Yeah, that part, I don't know that I needed it to be as heavy as it was, but I'll tell you what, this movie's 90 minutes. 10 minutes into the movie, I go to the front of my seat, didn't leave it till 30 seconds before the credits rolled. This is, in my opinion, the first movie I saw this year that I will say Oscar. Not Oscar winner, but Oscar. I know you felt that way about The Butler. Didn't you feel that way about The Butler?
I did not.
No, you did not feel that way. Somebody else.
I feel that way about Mud. But it's, that movie is too old to like get any play. And what was the other one? Prisoners.
Yeah.
But Prisoners won't win either because it's scary.
That's right. Prisoners won't win it. The movie I thought might be there, the two that I really like, Fruitvale Station and the, I always forget the name of this movie, The Incredible Now or The Amazing Now or The Spectacular Now, it's called. those movies are both too small. I mean, hardly anybody saw those. So those were the best movies I'd seen before this one this year. And those aren't going to do it. This movie will easily be one of the Oscar nominees.
Oscar nominee for best movie or for like cinematography or something like that? Because is it a good movie or is it a good Oscar movie?
It's a good movie. It is a good movie. It will be in the top movies for the Oscar. Sandra Bullock is best actress. I don't know. George Clooney is best actor. I don't know. This movie's so much about the situation, and they play characters that, frankly, I think almost anybody could play. This is more about the director and the story than it was about who played those roles. Okay. And certainly Clooney does. You know, I mean, when you got veterans like Bullock and Clooney, they could bring it. You know, but it wasn't like what was the movie? Was it called The Heat? The funny movie that we reviewed at the beginning of the summer. You know, there Sandra Bullock did a hell of a job. And I recognize that she did a great job in that movie. In this movie, I think you could have stuck any veteran actor in there, and your job is not to screw it up. Just
now, do you think that they should have charged more because of the cost of filming in space? Or
that's right. I did wonder sometimes how they got her to look like she's in space, and
because she was in space, right?
And weightless. Not that I know. Did they? What are you talking about?
Well, the movie's about being in space, right? I mean, you can't replicate that on Earth, so I can only presume that they went into outer space and filmed it.
No, right? No, they have that. They have a few ways you can film it, but
in space is what you're saying. One way is in space; the other way is also in space.
In the space between your ears, dude.
I wonder, like, how hard it was to carry a camera while floating in space. Do you have to practice?
Oh,
how do you practice? Oh, they do it underwater. That's right. I saw Apollo 13. They practice underwater, upside down in the time capsule thing, or whatever the hell that's called. Not a time capsule, I guess. That would be a different movie. And then in outer space. So
I can't wait for the theme music to come up. We'll see you next week. We'll have a bunch of FinCon interviews next week, OG.
Sweet. I'm gonna do nothing except watch lots of movies.
Fantastic. Bring me popcorn.
Chop, chop.
Later on.
This show is the property of the Free Financial Advisor, LLC. Copyright 2013. The Making Sense Babe appears courtesy of MakingSenseBabe.com, and if I play my cards right, she'll also appear at dinner with me on Saturday night. It appears I've fallen, and I can't get up.
OG. I know you're already a member, but I wonder if the rest of our audience knows that becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you save and earn more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you could start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal's savings option for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project, maybe you want to consolidate debt. You could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed-rate home equity loan with zero closing costs, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Both options could help make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.